tree by the 31st of July. So maybe we've done that already. I don't know if anyone can put their hand up and say we've done that, or otherwise it'll just be remaining on our action list, but hopefully has been done. No, not sure. That's okay. Someone will come back to us. Yep. The next one, we may like Dr. Palmer to come forward for. That'd be great. And welcome along, Anita. So, yeah, as we all know, Andrew Newman isn't available this afternoon, so Anita is going to help us.
And I'm going to pass this one completely over to Kevin, because obviously Dr. Palmer's on the working group.
So it's brilliant to have Dr. Palmer, and we, for those who've been around for a wee while, we will remember that there's been an ongoing issue of no linkage, I guess, to, with the regulations to give full effect to the framework for dam safety management, which is in the Building Act, and we've been a bit hamstrung. Brilliant to see that Dr. Palmer has been a member of the Dam Safety Technical Working Group, who's actually been advising MB on this proposed framework. Also important to note that we have taken up the authority, I suppose, for Southland and the West Coast as well. So we're considering, I suppose, wider ramifications. And the recommendation is to approve the draft ORC feedback. So, Dr. Palmer, do you need to add some more to that?
Madam Chair, if I might just recap briefly on the, on the history of dam safety. So, dam safety's been around for decades. Came to a bit of a head in the 1980s with the failure of the Whaio and Ruahihi canals in the Bay of Plenty. Further scrutiny with the corporatisation and then privatisation of government assets in the government reforms of the 1980s, leading to dam safety provisions in the current Building Act, which came into effect in 2004. That relies on regulations to give full effect to it. So you may recall that the government promulgated some regulations in 2008. Prior to that, those regulations commencing, Cabinet made the decision to defer commencement, undertake further review of the situation, and that culminated in the government making the decision around 2015 to repeal those regulations in full and to instead manage dam safety through the Resource Management Act and a National Environmental Standard. That gave rise to the working group that I became a part of. So we started again, started to frame up what regulations would look like. A discussion document was prepared in 2017, and then that was parked up pending the last general election. So things have been on hold since then. There was a change in government, and the current government decided it would not pursue it through the Resource Management Act and would instead put it back in the Building Act. It's reframed the discussion document into the form that you have before you, and in short, we're back where we were in 2006. It's substantially the same, apart from some improvements. It has improved. There's a better evidential basis, but it's largely the same. So with that background in mind, the Act is there. These proposed regulations fill the gap that was created with the repeal around 2008 of the regulations. Secondly, this has been thoroughly analysed. There is a good balance between compliance cost and public safety risk. It's been very heavily scrutinised by stakeholders over those years. And thirdly, the government is very close to landing this, but time is running out. With the next general election looming, there's less than 12 months to complete this, turn it into regulation, and make it happen. So that requires real commitment and drive from this point forward. Happy to take questions.
Good. I guess there are some real ramifications too, which people may like to comment on and ask you questions about. Councillor Kempton.
Yeah, I'd like to assist the government in this respect and move the recommendation.
Thank you.
A couple of things that I think are key here is that I remember when this came through and we just put our hands up to there aren't any regulations, that didn't mean a lot. But we've got a combination of volume and dam height, which we didn't used to have. And when you think about, and then we've also got an overlay around around risk and around risk management, which in those two things I think are really important additions. When you think about There's a pond at Trotters that's fed from Trotters Gorge in North Otago, which has on one side of it the main trunk railway, on very close to it on the other side the state highway, and one might have a look at that under these regulations and might make some different decisions. So I'm heartened by that. So I'm happy to move.
Okay, thank you. Do we have a seconder then, Councillor Hope? Oh, you want to speak as well?
Yes, I can. So, through the chair, Dr. Palmer, I've got two questions for you. Well, first of all, I think this has been well overdue. There's certainly got some grunt to it, but I have two questions to ask you, and they are on page 6, if you like, or are looking at 12 and 13. Now, in the paragraph 5, it says if over a certain volume. Will the working group or will you identify what that volume will be? That's my first question. And my second question to you is just below, or just above 13 and below 12 at the last statement. And this is quite common for us, for example, on our station we've got 30 dams. What if the entire storage facility is below ground level? Is that included too? That's something that I think probably needs to be clarified.
Through you, Madam Chair, the certain volume referred to in paragraph 12 is 30,000 cubic metres. That's an important addition because there are dams that are low height but relatively high volume, things like stormwater detention dams in urban settings that warrant being considered for inclusion in the scheme, and that's the purpose of that. In respect of ponds that are below ground, those are not ordinarily regarded as dams and would be excluded unless it had a component above ground. Created by fill from the excavation. There are those kind of situations.
Thank you. Councillor Lawton, Woodhead and Scott. Lawton.
Yeah, thank you. This is a very basic sort of question. I was trying to figure out what Councillor Hope was saying in terms of what actually constitutes a dam and what sort of businesses are likely to be affected by this. So it talked about storage ponds versus, when I say think dams, I think dams, like big dams, but actually there's a whole, obviously, range of different types and sizes. So can you give some examples, I guess, across the different industries around where this might have effect?
Yes. So through you, Madam Chair, a dam is defined by its form, not by its function. And so dam in the Building Act is defined as a barrier, water or any other fluid. And it includes its appurtenant structures. So it will include things like penstocks. It includes spillways. And so the types of things that are included would be snow-making dams on mountainsides above ski fields. It includes tailings dams, so fluid other than water. It would include, depending on scale, wastewater effluent ponds. It includes stormwater detention ponds that are ordinarily empty but fill up with stormwater or floodwater. And the reason being is that they all have similar risks potentially. The risk of uncontrolled release of some sort of fluid that would be harmful to people or property.
Councillor Woodhead, then Scott, then Alison.
I just wanted to clarify paragraph 14, Dr. Palmer, that you've stipulated there the difference between the low and the medium and high reporting frameworks. So I just wanted to clarify that the low PICs don't have to report annually on their Dam Safety Assurance Program.
That's correct. Dam Safety Assurance Program is only required for medium and high. So the low classification has to be revisited periodically.
5 yearly.
Yep, provided it's still low, there's nothing further required.
Thank you.
Councillor Scott.
What are the resource implications if this goes through?
So for this council, we would need to administer the scheme. It is largely administrative because the technical side of the work is done by the recognised engineers employed and paid for by the owner. But we would receive those classifications and we would check that they have been signed off by a recognised engineer, and that's largely administrative. There will be some cost.
Mr. Allison.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Palmer, the recognised engineer. What are the qualifications of a recognised engineer, and are there are sufficient numbers of them around to do this sort of work.
Yes. So the qualifications have been set out in the Building Act. A chartered professional engineer, and then some competency standards specified in these regulations. As to capacity, there probably is enough, given that for many dams, they will only require the assessment of whether they're low, medium or high PIC, which is a reasonably straightforward technical task, and nothing further.
I was wondering, with the Dam Safety Assurance Program, and yeah, there's the requirement there to have ongoing monitoring and maintenance protocols in place, just how much of a difference and how, I guess, onerous that would be for people with dams. Hmm.
Through you, Madam Chair, it shouldn't be onerous for owners managing the dams properly. Many are. Some of them are doing it through conditions of RMA consents that require compliance with the dam safety guidelines anyway. Those guidelines have been modernised by New Zealand Society on Large Dams recently. So it's not onerous because it's geared to the risk of the dam. At the small end, it'll be quite minimal. At the high end, it'll be quite rigorous, but those owners do those things anyway.
Well, thank you for your resilience throughout this over quite some time, and Councillor Woodhead too, I think, and perhaps some people who may even be in the public forum may have been involved in this initially, so and probably still. It's a long process, yes. We do have a mover and a seconder. Oh, sorry, Councillor Deaker, did you want to speak before that?
Just a quick question of Dr. Palmer, which you may not be able to answer. But if I'm a landowner and I've got a classifiable dam and it needs to be assessed, what's that going to cost me to get this engineer bloke or person to come onto my property and do the assurance? What's the bill going to be?
So, in my opinion, the costs that are stated in the submission in the document are very high. I think the true cost is a lot less than what is put in the discussion document. Importantly, the classification is not an assessment of the integrity of the dam. It's looking at the consequence if the dam were to fail. It can be a desktop exercise based on readily available information, contours and contour maps, yep, and Google and the like. I can't put a number on it. But it's not, in my opinion, very high cost. And once it's done once, the review of that should be even cheaper. It will not change unless there has been development downstream of the dam.
Okay. Alrighty then. Mover and a seconder. I'll put it all in favour.
Aye.
Against. Carried. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Palmer. The General Manager's report on progress then, and I am mindful of time. Some of this can obviously be taken as read. I don't think we want to be labouring through everything today, but there are some really important issues in here though.
Yep.
And a very, very good report highlighting such things as what's come up in the recent budget, which sends some really clear signals to us, some of which we've just been discussing about the way New Zealand will farm into the future and things like that. And a number of other updates there in terms of when consultation might be on some of the upcoming national regulations, which is very soon. And, so I'm going to just, if there's anything you really want to touch on, Anita, maybe give you a chance to do that, then I'm just going to open it up.
Yeah, so I guess there's just a couple of points through you, Madam Chair. We're starting mediation on Dunedin City's 2GP next week, so that's really positive. We have been continuing conversations with them throughout this process, so that's been really helpful, and I think we've narrowed the topic, so that's really good. As Madam Chair rightfully pointed out, there's some budget implications in terms of the Regional Council, a if I take you to paragraph 29, a $43 million investment into Overseer, which tells us that Overseer isn't going away, and they are trying to sharpen its use as a regulatory tool. Obviously, it's already in our plan framework. I'm happy to answer any questions, but there's probably not a whole lot. I think I heard mentioned earlier about the Yellow-Eyed Penguin Trust and the Poor Wee Penguin. So obviously we've received a report about the penguins, and there's some issues going on in their environment, which is obviously of concern. In fact, it's pretty grim reading. When I was putting it into the report, it wasn't... I was looking for the silver lining, but clearly the scientists there are on track for figuring out what's going on. So we just thought that was a really important piece of information to share with you guys, just to, you know, obviously those environments are often at the end of our freshwater environments, and they receive what happens up in the high country. So, yeah, but happy to answer any questions.
Got heaps lining up already. You've got Councillor Kempton, Brown, Deeker, and someone over here. Scott, Councillor Kempton.
Yes, I'm sure some of us probably want to ask the same question. You've got some real pressure points there in terms of direction from central government that we have to respond to, and in terms of policy statements and such like. But also, of course, we've got a multitude of budget initiatives. Resourcing, giving you any cause for concern around resourcing both of those things? I know that we've got to make some specific arrangements around submissions relating to NPSs and so on, and then of course the budget stuff that might have implications for us. Any concerns?
I'll always tell you that the team isn't big enough, so yes, I suppose. The key thing for a lot of this national policy direction is actually how it talks to each other. So it's when we've got competing demands from national policy statements that create the bigger issues for us rather than things that are trying to drive the same direction. That might come about through the proposed policy statement for highly productive land and the urban development one. So as I understand it, the intention is that highly productive land will classify everything that's land use class 1 to 3. As highly productive soil, and the intention is for quite stringent policies around what you can and can't do with that. In areas of our region that are growing and expanding, that's the flat land that's often close to urban centres, that's often the most demanded. So those sorts of things actually create bigger issues than just the number of national policy statements coming out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think it was Councillor Brown.
Yeah, I just want to talk about the NPS and highly productive land. I'm just saying I'm very supportive of this. I think there's councils around New Zealand have got different policies of dealing with this. When land subdivision takes place, and I think it's high time we had a look at it. So I'm just saying it's highly supportive of this, and we need to have a good look at it.
Great, thank you.
Councillor
Deeker.
Yeah, so I agree with Councillor Brown. What I'm curious about is the definition of highly productive land, because in Otago we tend to immediately think of where Councillor Brown lives and farms. We think of Outram, we think of North Tyree, we think of beautiful, deep, rich soils. But we know as Otago people that land which has almost no soil whatsoever, like old dredge tailings and sluicing areas, are in fact some of our most highly productive land. It suits grapevines wonderfully to have no soil. And look at Bendigo and Bannockburn and a heap of other places I could name. Now, is that in the NPS going to be classified as highly productive land on which urban development should not occur?
So through you, Madam Chair, the initial direction we've been given is that originally everything that's land use class 1 to 3 as a baseline will be identified as highly productive land to enable councils to then region by region specify their own criteria. So it'll basically hold a line, and then you'll be able to do that. So there's no reason why we can't identify some particular land that isn't 1 to 3. Yep.
Okay.
Hey, good. Councillor Scott.
Are we going to get a presentation on the yellow-eyed penguin?
Yes.
I mean, it was suggested that they're on track, but it seems to me there's not a lot on track.
They know what's going on.
Thank you, Councillor Scott, I think.
Sorry.
Yep.
Thank you.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Yep. Okay, any other hands? Mr. Allison, Councillor Hope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just with the yellow-eyed penguin, I think, is there a warming seas issue as well associated?
I can't answer that, actually. I'm not sure. Yeah, it didn't come through in the report. That's not to say it's not.
My real question is, have the ORC identified any potential issues with the Billion Trees program and how it might roll out and impact in Otago negatively?
I don't know that any specific work's been done around that yet. Obviously, there are some benefits, significant benefits from afforestation, but there are, you know, there's the converse as well. So I'm not aware of any work particularly that we've done in that space yet.
Ms. Gardner says she could comment.
Not in a whole lot of detail, but there is a sector approach to Billion Trees, looking at both opportunities, but also, obviously, the flip side of that, which is concern about, you know, planting in the right place for the right reason, etc. So I can report back on where the sector's at in more detail, if you'd like.
It does remind me, and some around the table will remember the Marginal Lands Development Program, good in part, vandalism and other.
Councillor Hope, then Lawton.
Thank you, through the chair. I was wondering, and I'm not trying to put dear old Councillor Bellier on the stand, but I was just wondering, number 44 talks about the first meeting of the Manaharaka Reference Group. It was held on Friday, 12th of July. I was just wondering, did he want to talk a little bit about it? And then I see there's another meeting set down for the 8th of August to be held at Moray, and I was just wanting to ask about that. That was all.
Just thought Councillor Bowell might like to comment.
Yes, only if that's all right. Sorry, we're going to put you on the spot. But
if you want to.
I can read from a report that I wrote, thinking that I might have to say something sometime, but I wasn't prepared for doing it as yet. But all I can say is that the first part has got underway pretty good, very good, it's something that pleased me because I've been trying to get these people around the kitchen table for many years. So finally they are all around there, and it's great to see them, the rapport going on, especially after the meeting. I guarantee there was well over half an hour more of them networking and getting on with it. So that was great. But it was really just getting it underway. But I have got more details in there, which I can give if I pull it out. But
we will wait for them. Stage. That's great. Thanks for that initial recap on it. Councillor Lawton.
I think part of the problem with the warming seas is that there's a lack of food for the penguins, and it's certainly it's an indicator species to see what is yet to come in terms of the fall over of our biodiversity. Yeah, speculation. Crikey. Okay.
When did you become
an expert?
Question. Paragraph 41. Can you just give us a bit of a background around the implications of the Bunnings decision to the plan change 5A to the Lindis? And why? So this point around economic efficiency versus financial viability?
Yeah, so, and I did read this case. I'm just trying to recall what it said. So Judge Jackson was the judge on the Bunnings case, and essentially there was an argument in Bunnings around trade competition and the difference between something being economically efficient versus financially viable. The MPSFM talks about efficiency, and so he was just looking for clarification to see if his determination in the Bunnings case, actually separating the two things, had any impact on the Lindis case. It was a little bit out of left field. Nobody was expecting it. So we're not necessarily sure where he's going with that, but all parties had the opportunity to respond.
Just this note 50 on omnibus plan change, the request for proposal for omnibus plan change has been released, and several providers have expressed an interest. I'm not sure if I remember the detail of... Well, I know what the omnibus plan change is, but, yeah, I don't quite understand that one.
It's just procuring a resource, I think.
Okay. Yes, yes, that's just getting additional planning support to assist the team.
Right. Okay, so that's all lined up in place. That's good.
Omnibus.
Councillor Hope.
Oh, sorry, my apologies. I meant to ask you, Ms. Dawes, before, just talking that there could be some changes still to those meetings that we originally went with you to Cadrona and to Arrow. How are we looking there?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So through you, Madam Chair, we were originally intending to be back in the Arrow and the Cadrona in early September and then in the Manahitiki at the end of September. We don't have all of our hydrology for the Cadrona yet. From NIWA, so we're going to push those dates out.
Yes.
And we are going to confirm early next week whether we can go to the Arrow still on those dates. The main reason we haven't been able to is our staff member's on annual leave, so we just need him to come back so we can figure out that we're on whether we're on track or not. We are still going to the Manahitiki at the end of September for the values conversation, and I've seen the map, so the same maps that you all saw in the Arrow and the Cadrona is just being finalised now for the Manahitiki, and it'll run largely in the same way that the other two did.
Not sure if we've commented on this before, but I think we may have asked to be tracking project progress on that timeline so that we can make sure it is on track or not. So we would be expecting, I guess, to see at each committee meeting the time frame and ticking whether we've met our time frames and just how off track or not we're going on them would be good. Yeah, it's pretty important. So
through you, Chair, that's intended to come in the August Council meeting.
Okay. Yep, thank you. Councillor Lawton, Councillor Deaker.
Thank you. Just following on from the questions from the public forum, actually, around the map, just that this map will give more specific detail around what the proposed Manahitiki catchment will actually be. So it was a question that we had originally with the map as well, was it didn't really give us a granular understanding of the boundary.
So through you, Madam Chair, the map that we've drawn up is exactly the same as the Arrow and the Cadrona. It shows the catchment that we're talking about, and it shows where the previously identified values are across that catchment, and it aligns with the FMU map.
Councillor Deaker, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've just remembered I couldn't understand paragraph 16, Anita.
My apologies.
No, it's not. It's probably my fault, not yours. The RPS... you say that mediation, staff are anticipating that it may be vacated. What's going to be vacated?
Yes, so through you, Madam Chair, we were hoping to avoid mediation by all parties agreeing to some alternate wording, and we did manage to do that. So we didn't. So you'll recall in about March or April, we had a procedural decision that questioned some facets of the RPS. Without any clear indication of exactly what the concern was, the judge had highlighted some particular concerns with wording. We proposed some new wording, and that was set down for mediation to discuss that wording, but we managed to resolve it before mediation, so all parties agreed.
So what does that mean for our RPS?
It hasn't changed the position, so the High Court appeal that we have on the validity of the RPS is still live. There was a teleconference on Monday around that, and it's now been set. It's now on the schedule to be scheduled for a hearing in the High Court. So that's still a live and valid argument.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Lawton, did you have something?
I'm okay.
Okay, great.
I'll move the recommendations, Madam Chair.
Have we done that? No, we haven't. Yep, thank you very much. Seconder, Councillor Brown, all in favour?
Aye.
Against? Carried. Thank you very much. Next paper then is drinking water, isn't it? And drafted by you, Anita, so that's great. Would you like to introduce this one? I think it's really a summary, isn't it, of a report nationally on where we're at with drinking water.
Yeah, absolutely. So the intention of bringing this paper to you was just for your noting. Obviously, we have some control in terms of drinking water, largely focused through the NES for drinking water around consenting and the sorts of activities that we make permitted or otherwise. But this was just a snapshot of where councils are at. I think the really critical thing to understand is non-compliance with the standards or the Health Act don't equate to a poor drinking water supply. So if you have a look through some of the reasons for failure, they are things like not taking enough samples, not getting the samples to the lab within a specified time, not having particular plans in place, not having the right monitoring. So it looks a little bit grim for our TAs, but there are some technical issues associated with some of these non-compliances.
I think it pointed out that Otago was in a relatively good position, I think, as well, compared with some.
So yeah. The summary from the Ministry of Health was that most people get good water most of the time, notwithstanding that there are these technical... And not all of the breaches are technical. Some of them are, you know, E. coli exceedances. You know, that's a real issue. The protozoal standards is a really interesting one. So there's been a drop nationally in that. I think it was around about 90% last year, and it's down to 75%. That standard is not about whether or not the organism is present, but it's if it is present, do you have the mechanism to adequately deal with it? So it's a slightly different test to some of the others, and there's been a real reduction, but no comment from the Ministry as to why they think there's less, you know, a lower level of compliance with that standard.
Thank you. Councillor Laws and Lawton.
Yes, I'm not quite so cavalier with the dismissal, to be perfectly honest with you. And I was a little disappointed to read, indeed, this paper to sort of say, oh, well, it's just technical problems. It's all right. The reality is that the majority of water drinking suppliers failed the national standards. And if you read the attachment, Madam Chair, you'll see the detail of where they failed those compliance. And we are responsible for overseeing this matter. I had a chance last night to look through the Havelock North inquiry, and one of the scathing criticisms that that inquiry noted was the role of the regional council in overseeing water drinking standards and not doing its job properly or sufficiently. And I am concerned that the Otago Regional Council are involved in exactly that problem now. When you dismiss this and say, oh, it's just technical, wait on, these are the standards. If you haven't been doing the monitoring and you say, oh, well, they're just not doing enough monitoring, you're monitoring for a reason, and that is to ensure that that the public of this country, particularly after the tragedy of Havelock North, can be assured that their drinking water is safe, not some of the time, but all of the time. And that's our role and responsibility. This makes for sorry reading, this attachment. And if we're going to let these people who are supplying or responsible for the supply of water get away with technical issues, then we're not doing our job. Now, we're already not doing our job when, for example, it comes to monitoring the compliance of regional consents around, for example, the Hawea wastewater treatment plant. But I hate to think that that kind of attitude is going to carry through to drinking water as well. So, Madam Chair, I guess the question I'm going to ask now is, having seen all these fails, there they are, they're listed, what are we going to do about it?
Good, very good question, yeah. Information for information's sake, all very well. It's come to Policy Committee, that's really good. But is there a further action other than receive the report, I guess, is the question. I don't know whether Ms Gardner has anything she might like to say with regard to that. What happens with this information and what's our leadership role in it or not?
Yeah, I've actually got...
Oh, sorry,
it might be helpful if I add in another bit, just you might be able to answer either... paragraph 8 highlights those aspects that regional council also has as a responsibility for not just
the bottom of the cliff, but also for protecting water source. And so how are we doing on that? Have we been taking that really seriously? Because ultimately that's going to protect the overall system, which is going to minimise costs to our community and increase health to the environment as well as people. Is there some sort of assessment, or exactly what are we going to do with this? Do we need to go through some sort of review?
Okay. So there's a number of moving parts in there, and I'm sure Ms. Dorr will assist me if I don't get them entirely correct. The first, I guess if we start at the top of the train, what we know is that the New Zealand government is undertaking a significant review of three waters, and in particular drinking water. So that's one of the first things to know, and they are particularly looking at these things, and I expect that we will see something coming out of the government in fairly short order, probably in the next calendar year, that talks about the management of supplies, management of drinking water at source, possibly looks at different regulation. And I know some of the questions that are being asked around the role of the Ministry of Health and its effectiveness, because we do have responsibilities for drinking water at source, but in terms of monitoring whether or not drinking water is fit for consumption, that's a health responsibility. And there are some supplier responsibilities as well, and you get that through your municipal councils, etc. In answer to your question about what we're doing around drinking water at source, I just remind you of the action we took in relation to the Lower Waitaki aquifer, where we did have E. coli coming through routine monitoring of that aquifer. As soon as we knew that, we were aware that that was being used for drinking water, not necessarily through supplies as such, but individual farmers drawing water from bores, etc. And you'll remember that we went, we looked at fecal source tracking and did that for a number of months in order to confirm where the source was coming from. We increased our monitoring of those bores, and we also issued warnings. First initially when we had the initial reading, and then subsequently when we had ongoing readings. And those warnings are still in place for the Lower Waitaki, which is, you know, don't drink the water out of your bore without treating it. And at the same time, we also provided a whole pile of information about how to look after your bore head and prevent E. coli issues in your drinking water. We do a whole bunch of stuff around environmental health monitoring, and if we do have issues with coli, it's now something that we look at. And if there was an issue around water supply at source, we would take a similar approach. We're not in the business of taking risks with people's livelihood, and where we have information that informs us of an issue, we will take action, and we will take it quickly.
So this attachment, if I might just then ask a supplementary, Madam Chair, these attachments which say fail,
yeah,
over those five pages, and the majority of them would appear to say fail, some of the breaches of the Health Act, is that the responsibility for enforcement of the Department or Ministry of Health? Which of these are our responsibilities to follow up then? Because that's not made clear here.
There isn't sufficient information here for me to be able to say, A, what the overall cause was, whether it was a source factor or whether it was a supply factor, a treatment factor, etc. So I can't answer that question on a case-by-case basis. What I can say, though, is that health definitely have a role to play and have been found wanting, and that's why we're seeing some of the Three Waters Review. And we certainly have the role to play that we play, which is the role at source. So effectively, before the water gets taken, what does it look like? If it's treated, that's a different issue.
But again, I'm asking the question, though. These fails that are,
yes,
over these, which of them,
yes,
are our responsibility to sort out?
Well, and that's exactly what I'm saying to you. I know what the fails are, and that they're listed here, but what I can't tell you off the top of my head right now is which ones are our responsibilities.
I'm wondering if maybe a paper on responsibilities in drinking water, perhaps, was drafted up for policy committee so that we understand who's responsible, really, is the issue. Because, we're here and we're sitting here and we can see fails. And, at some point somebody has to be responsible. So understanding that picture would be good, and it's a complex one, but let's do that properly so that we're not, jumping to something right now. But it's important. Councillor Scott.
My question is whether it would be an appropriate step for a risk assessment to be carried out for every particular supply. And in that way, it would provide some type of context in terms of the fail and the significance of that fail. Certainly, if I was a user of a supply, I would want to know what the variables are, and what the key variable, what the significant variables are, and what the. So, if you gave us a paper and basically said, "Okay, it was a fail, but it was actually very low and acceptable risk," and it's been analysed, and these are the variables.
We'd need to know it was our responsibility, I guess, to get into that much detail to know all
that. I'm just saying.
I'm just trying happy to bring you a paper.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that is occurring, chief executives from the TAs and myself are meeting with DIA for a second time. We met with them, and I was on Skype during the LGNZ conference. We're meeting a second time because it's becoming somewhat clear to us that we need to work together across Otago, all of the agencies involved, in looking at drinking water and how we administer that. And it's not just about, treatment or what happens at source, but it's actually about supply and infrastructure as well through the Three Waters Reform.
I guess another key thing would be, as we do discuss FMUs and values and limits and things, drinking water and the catchment that the drinking water comes from, whether it's, say, the Waitaki or it's the Top of the Rock and Pillars, they're both drinking water supplies, and how we manage that and the values will be something we'll need to discuss, I guess, too. So where are we at then? I think for our sake as councillors, understanding what our responsibility is in drinking water again might be helpful. I don't know if I want to put a time frame on that because you've got to move the target on that.
Difficult though, Madam Chair. I mean, finding out what... And I'd also say...
Each of the individual ones, but currently where legislation is for district councils, public health, us,
I would suspect that as part of the Three Waters work, there's probably already some kind of publication that we could draw on, so we'll sort that out.
Yep. And if it is unclear, then the paper can say it's unclear, and that's fine. Okay. Sorry, Councillor Hope.
You know already?
Madam Chair, if I may, I think the answer is fairly clear. The overwhelming responsibility sits with the person that is providing the drinking water, and to the extent that they are overseen, it is primarily by the Ministry of Health, and district officers of health have a role with that. The New Zealand Drinking Water Standard is a risk-based standard where the level of treatment that you need to provide reflects the risks that's associated with the source, and the role that regional councils have is under the National Policy Statement for Drinking Water, which requires us to do things that protect the source of the water from which it comes from. So it's an RMA responsibility in that respect, not a public health responsibility, which sits with the territorial authorities and the Ministry of Health. So I haven't got the attachment in front of me, but I think you'll discover that most of the non-compliances relate to a non-compliance with the New Zealand Drinking Water Standard and enforcement of that, and anything that comes with that sits with the Ministry of Health.
Except some of them, just to answer that, when I look through here, if I was, for example, in one of the 150 people who's drawing water from the Close Burn Water Company, and I discovered that in actual fact they haven't been investigating any complaints into E. coli, and I was one of those 150, and I had my family in that area, and that was reported to us, I'd ask the question, I think. But I don't even know if they've got that answer, you know, this information. You know what I mean? And so a lot of this information here, what responsibilities might we like to take? Because it doesn't get more important, particularly after Havelock North, than our role in, I guess, more than just a statutory role, but also a moral responsibility to ensure clean drinking water in our region.
So again, Madam Chair, one of the key issues that the government's addressing in its review of Three Waters is the nature of public drinking supplies that are in essence private and not provided by territorial authorities. And that's one of the areas where they're actively exploring the potential for far stronger regulation. So that is currently where they're exploring, and it's quite likely that as a result of changes later this year, they will move into a very different and far more highly regulated space. And I don't believe that regional councils will be called upon to undertake that role.
No, I think that's right. I think we may well see not necessarily an increase in our responsibilities, but a change in expectation. But I think I agree with Mr. Winder about what I think you can expect to see is perhaps regulation where there has effectively been none around different types of water supplies other than municipal supplies.
Councillor Hope.
Thank you. I was just going to say, could we add to that we see there's 55 registered sites here? Is there others that we know about that aren't registered though as well that we could probably perhaps include in that report?
Through the chair, it gets really difficult because you know, there's formal and informal arrangements. So, for example, we know that there might be one farmer who has a bore and he actually supplies himself for drinking water and his neighbour and his shearer's cottage and somebody else, and, you know, that's quite informal as opposed to the more formal arrangements. So we won't know about all of them.
Okay. Well, there is a recommendation to receive this report. Somebody care to move that? Councillor Hope seconded. Councillor Noon, I'll put it. All in favour?
Mm-hmm. Aye.
Against? Carried. Great. Well, that brings us to a close. Thank you very much of the Policy Committee.